Welcome. You're listening to the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast, live from the Fly Fishing Show in Denver, Colorado. Fly Fishing Journeys is proud to be broadcasting live from the event and having great conversations with many of the finest fly fishing and fly tying experts in the world. You can find these podcasts posted to our website, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and Facebook. To stay up to date with these and other Fly Fishing Journeys adventures, please be sure to follow and subscribe. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
This is quite possibly one of the coolest stories I have ever heard. Sun Tao and his flies have been an internet sensation. Tying for just a few short years, his flies are meticulous and beautiful. And in the short time, he has grown his Instagram channel to over 30,000 followers. How is this possible? Well, in addition to his gorgeous flies, his photography is stunning, and we learn about the equipment and the process he uses to get such amazing photos. Above all this, Sun shares his origin story, how he came to America, and how he ended up as a first sergeant in the United States Army. Just amazing. Please do me a favor, and after listening, share this podcast with someone you know who loves fly fishing or fly tying. I think they will find it just as fascinating as I did. So here's our big announcement. Fly Fishing Journeys has started a YouTube vlog. The first episode is posted and it's Monster Brook Trout of Labrador. The second episode is about to drop and that's Iceland's Ice Age Brown Trout and Arctic Char. You can find this channel by searching for Fly Fishing Journeys on YouTube. Please check us out and subscribe as we have a bunch of new episodes coming soon. Speaking of Iceland, we're heading back, and we have a couple spots left on our trip if you want to join us. Check out Iceland2020.net for all the details. Thanks to our sponsors. You can catch Sun Tao at the Denver Fly Fishing Show the first weekend of January. Find all the details at flyfishingshow.com. We're going to get to the pod right after a short message from our favorite rotary vise.
From the original prototype designed in the late 70s to our brand new legacy stainless steel vise released in 2018, Norvise has been committed to one thing, efficiency. Tie better flies faster. A long-standing slogan with the company truly encompasses what the Norvise fly tying system does. What it means is to tie a fly in less time and more consistently due to the ease and benefits engineered into this outstanding system. For more information, please visit www.nor-vise.com. Norvise, the most innovative fly tying system on the market.
Okay, great. Welcome back live to the Denver Fly Fishing Show, and we're so excited here to have Sun Tao here at the podcast. Sun, thank you so much for being on our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We've connected online, and we're Facebook friends, and you're posting in our community and posting online, and you've really been kind of a whirlwind of your flies. They're just kind of all over the place on Instagram, and they're gorgeous. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how you got into fly tying, but before we even do that, why don't we talk about your history? Where did you grow up, Sun?
Well, I was born in South Vietnam. We left out of there in, 1976, I think it was.
Okay.
Somewhere around there.
Yep.
And then it was basically a couple years after the war. And my father was in the South Vietnamese Army, so he was pretty much being persecuted if he stayed there.
Wow.
So we left out of there, and we went to a Malaysian refugee camp. It's a little island off the coast of Malaysia called Palau Badang. And at any given time, there was anywhere from 10 to 20,000 Vietnamese refugees that lived on that island. So we were there for about a year and a half, and my parents had requested political asylum in numerous different countries, mostly Europe, because we have a lot of family in Europe. And they all said no. And the U.S. was the only country that said yes. So the reason I ended up in, Amish country, Pennsylvania, was there was this Mennonite family that sponsored my family. They just basically went through a refugee book, found our picture, because I have a little sister and a little brother. My little brother was born in Malaysia also. My sister was born in Vietnam like me. They saw us there and they said, okay, we'll take this family. So with their help, they helped with the visa applications, all the paperwork, and then the airfare, and then that's how we got to the U.S. was through their help. And then, so I grew up in Pennsylvania, went to college, got my engineering degree, worked at RCA for several years as a development engineer, and then 9/11 happened. So 9/11 occurred, my father was like, hey, you gotta join the service because you're the oldest, we gotta pay back for the U.S. allowance to come here, and I'm like, what? because I was living a really comfortable life, single, with no school loans and whatnot, and making good money at RCA. And next thing you know, I submitted my letter of resignation to RCA, because in my culture, you don't tell your parents no, and joined the Army. And then 17 and a half years later, I'm currently a first sergeant. I'm during, I would say it was about 3 years ago was when I got introduced to fly fishing. After the last deployment that I had there in Hawaii, I was in a bad state where I was injured over in combat. I lost a bunch of soldiers, so I was drinking heavily. And it was just so happened it was at a bar where I met this Korean vet that, you know, just saw me sitting there just wasting away. And he came over and kept on trying to talk to me, and I didn't want to be dealt with. But then he brought up the subject of fishing. And that intrigued me because growing up in Pennsylvania, you know, I walked around, rode around my little BMX and fished just about every creek within 5 miles of my bike riding distance. So I was an avid fisherman as a kid with spinning rods and whatnot. When he brought up the subject of fishing, I paid attention, and he started talking, and I told him, you know, I've been in the service now for, you know, over a decade, and I really haven't had a chance to fish because we were constantly deploying all the time and coming back, getting ready to go again. And he's like, have you fished in Hawaii? And I was like, no. And so he's like, wait right here. I only live down the road. I'll be right back. And I'm like, okay. The guy took off, came back, and he brought with him this little metal contraption, and he started spinning up with threads and whatnot. And I knew about fly fishing growing up in PA, but I never really was interested in it. So he started tying a couple flies, and he showed me what to do, and he's like, here, just tie one, I'll take you fishing if you're available this weekend. So he showed me how to tie my first fly. It was a little shrimp pattern called a gotcha, and he's like, you sure you've never done this before? And I was like, no, I've never touched a vise or any of this stuff before. And he's like, well, you're tying better than me. And I'm like, whatever. Thought he was just not going to make me feel good. And then he took me down to Kaneohe Bay, which is a Marine Corps base, and right there's a huge sandbar flat that runs about a mile and a half around the bay. And there's a lot of fish that swim through there. And gave me this fly rod, showed me how to make some short little casts and where to throw the line and whatnot. And, you know, there were so many fish in there that they don't get a lot of fly fishing pressure that my second or third cast, I hooked onto this big bonefish. And then I'm, like, struggling to get this in. He's telling me what to do. And finally, we get this fish in. Now, the funny story part of the story is I had no idea what a trophy-sized bonefish was in. I just thought it was just another saltwater fish that we pulled in. And when I ended up leaving Hawaii for my next duty assignment and went to my first fly shop, and I was looking at the fish on the wall, and I saw a bonefish hanging up. And I was like, oh, that's a little tiny one. He's like, no, that's a good-sized one. You know, the owner caught this down in the Bahamas. You know, it's a 4 or 5 pounder. I'm like, oh. So I show him a picture of the one that I got in Hawaii, and I'm like, this is what I was catching there. And it was a 12-pound bonefish.
Oh, my goodness.
So I had no idea that I had caught a trophy-sized bonefish until, like, you know, a year later. That was just, like, basically, he gave me a taste of what fly fishing was like. I mean, I was pretty much hooked at that point. But I got to Indiana between the move, getting my kids into school, and then going constantly TDY all the time, which is basically, you know, temporary duty where we were traveling to different parts of the U.S., meeting up with different units that were getting ready to deploy. The fishing kind of got lost by the wayside. And then one day I saw an advertisement for the Sports and Outdoor Show in the Indianapolis Convention Center. I was like, yeah, I'll check it out. I got finished working at it early that day, and I was still in uniform. And I walked by a Project Healing Waters booth, and they flagged me down. I had a big bullseye on my back because I was in uniform. And they're like, hey, come here, soldier. And then they started explaining what they did as far as the program and how they take vets fishing and the whole nine yards. I was like, oh, maybe it's a good way for me to get introduced to some different spots and whatnot. So I signed up with them. And then my first outing that I did with them, you know, I didn't know anybody. Being a vet with really bad PTSD from all the different brain injuries that I had, I left. So I didn't even stay.
Wow.
Because I didn't know anybody, and I was uncomfortable when I left. And then that's when I got a phone call from the coordinator. He's like, hey, where'd you go? I was looking for you. It's like, hey, I didn't feel comfortable with those guys there. So I left. And then those guys kind of took me under their wing, and they took me out on a private outing. And we went after muskie, actually. Didn't catch anything, but we had 7 follows. So to see a 3-foot fish follow my fly in there, it was pretty intriguing. And then that pretty much got my start again with the fly fishing. Now, tying-wise, there was a different story. I saw the Fly Masters of Indianapolis on Google Maps was approximately, you know, 5 miles from my house. And it was right off the exit that I take every day when I got home. So I pulled in there and talked to a couple of the guys, and I was really impressed with them because here I was. I had no idea about what gear I needed. I had nothing. And they took their time, explained everything to me, having no idea whether I was going to actually purchase anything or not. But they spent literally that first day there almost 2 hours just talking to me. And then you know, they found out that I was a vet and whatnot, and they gave me a vice to use.
Wow.
There's this little Renzetti traveler, and he gave me the tools and materials and this big book, and he's like, just check it out. You know, you get more interested, come back here, we'll give you some lessons and whatnot.
Okay.
So I went home that night, paged through the book, and it was The Founding Flies, written by Mike Valla, 43 fly masters and their patterns and whatnot. So I was paging through it, and growing up, I was always a major history nerd. I love history more than anything. And I'm just reading through it, and then I was hooked right off the bat, just reading about the history, about these old Catskill patterns. And read about Theodore Gordon and how the fly, dry flies got started, and how he basically incorporated British flies and made them into American flies, so they worked up in the Catskill regions in New York. And I was like intrigued by the ginger quill.
Okay.
Just looking at it, it was such a gorgeous fly. So I'm going through all the materials that he gave me to see if I had enough there to tie that fly there. And they didn't. So I went back to the fly shop the next day, and I bought a couple of the duck quills for the wings and some hackle and whatnot. I went home and started tying this fly. Well, I couldn't get it to look like anything like in the book. So I went back to the fly shop again after I ran through all the duck quill and bought two more packets. Long story short, I ended up tying about 125 of that fly until I finally got it to look exactly like it did in the book. And then I found Google. And I looked for the ginger quill on there, like, oh crap, it doesn't look like anything. Like, so I tied it that first fly until I got it to look like the way that Theodore Gordon had tied it. And the hackle and then the materials they used back then was vastly different than what we use today. And then all the ones today are much more streamlined, a lot cleaner because it's better quality hackle, better quality material. So I went at it again. I finally tied that fly until I was really, really happy with it. And it came out to probably about 200 flies of that exact same one.
Before you got to where you were happy.
And then I found out I did it the hard way, where most people start off on simple patterns, and I just tied a fly that I like. Well, it actually worked out in the long run to my benefit, because when I realized that there were other much simpler patterns to tie, everything else was a lot easier. Yeah, so I started tying the Quill Gordons and the Adams and all these other ones. They were a million times easier. So I didn't struggle with it. It took maybe four or five tries, and I was spinning these out, and then I eventually tied every fly in that book, including all the deer hair patterns, irresistible, and this was all just from looking at it. And that's where my background in engineering really helped, because I was able to look at the fly and look at the materials and reverse engineer on how they did everything without a how-to instructions. And then I found out there were YouTube videos and other instructional books, but at that point right there, I was happy with the way I was learning, because I was learning the hard way. I was learning how to do proper thread control, how to do correct amount of pressure when I'm tying in materials, and the least amount of materials possible in order to get the fly not to look bulky. So I learned all that the hard way, and that really benefited me, you know, year down the road, 2 years down the road, where I'm able to spit out these patterns. Now, the perfectionist in me is basically what you guys see, where if I tie something and I see a mistake on it, where it might be something that's not even noticeable by somebody else, but I'll see it, and I'll stop what I'm doing, I'll redo it all over again until I get exactly right. So it has to be 100% perfect until I'm satisfied with that fly. And the other part to it is, in school, when I was in junior high and high school, I was really big into art, and where I did a lot of painting, a lot of sketching and whatnot, and then I think the two really go hand in hand, which is the art aspect of the tying, and the end of the day is like, you know, people say it's the fish that's going to decide, which is ultimately true, but
right.
If you tie a good fly and you're really happy with that fly, you can have more confidence in that fly than something that you just, oh, it'll work. So I like to think that what I'm doing is a form of art, but at the same time, they catch fish too.
This is an amazing story, son. I had no idea about all this, and I'd like to go back here to the beginning when you were talking about your dad being persecuted in Vietnam. It was about 1975, 76. About how old were you at that time?
At 1976, I was only 2 years old. I was born in 74.
Okay. Do you have any remembrance of that?
A little bit. I remember bits and pieces of Vietnam. I remember more at the refugee camp.
Sure.
I remember the trip over from
Malaysia.
There was a lot of death because basically we boarded a smuggler ship to get out of there. They took whatever they could with them, which was mostly jewelry, because that was the only currency that was worthwhile.
Yep.
And then halfway there, the one thing that I really do remember vividly is there were a lot of people that were being thrown overboard, and as a little kid, I had no idea why.
Wow.
And it was never really explained to me. And then years later, when I was in my teens, I started getting a lot of nightmares about that. And that's when my mom explained to me that people were dying on the ship from dysentery and whatnot, and rather than, you know, having them rot in the ship, they threw them overboard, and then they were basically to get rid of the bodies, and so other people didn't get sick.
That's tragic.
The other thing that I had found out was halfway through the journey also, we were running out of a lot of water was the big thing, and people were dehydrated, and we were actually robbed by a Thailand pirate ship, and they took, you know, a lot of people's jewelries and whatnot, because they knew the refugees took everything they had with them.
Yeah.
But in return, they actually gave us water, and that allowed us to finish the journey to Malaysia.
Wow. Generous pirates.
Yeah, it was either that or we were going to die, and they ended up just giving us water.
They just wanted your jewelry.
They just wanted the jewelry. They didn't want you to die. Yeah, so people were swallowing diamonds and rings and whatnot so that they at least had something when they got to the refugee camp.
And then how old were you when you went over to Pennsylvania?
By the time I got to Pennsylvania, after we started off in Oakland, California, for the first 9 months of my experience in the U.S. was in the inner city. And then that church got us from California out to Pennsylvania, so I was about 6 years old then.
Okay. And so who was it?
The church is called Grafton Mennonite. They're based out of New Holland, Pennsylvania, in Lancaster County.
And then in your family, like what members, who was there?
All five of us made it.
So you was your mom, your dad?
My brother and my sister.
And your brother and your sister. Yeah.
So we were very fortunate. A lot of families usually had at least one fatality or something, but we made it there with all five.
And so they kind of take in the whole family.
Yep.
This other family would take in all five of you.
Yeah, we still stay really close contact with them. They're in like their 80s now, but they basically became like adopted grandparents to me.
It's unbelievable.
That's how we end up. I mean, I know it's a cliche, but like my brother, my sister, and I, we end up living the American dream when we came over with nothing, and we all end up with college educations and became relatively successful.
That's
I'm the
so
dumbest
cool.
one out of the group for joining the Army, but.
Well, you did it because your dad asked you to. No, let me talk about that. You just got a new rank?
Yep.
A second sergeant?
No, a first sergeant.
First sergeant.
Yep. Basically, on the enlisted scale, it goes from E1 to E9. I'm an E8. And then I'm responsible for a company. I'm the senior guy in the company, and then I mentor the company commander. So we have anywhere from 140 to 240 soldiers that fall underneath us, and I'm ultimately responsible for the health and the welfare and the training of all those men.
140 people.
Yeah.
And you said you're about 17 years in now?
Yeah.
You stay in by choice now?
Yeah, it's basically, that's how they usually get us, is most of us plan on doing 3 years and going back to the civilian world. But then I got married, and then given the choice when I was about to hit the 3-year mark, if I get out, you know, I have to go back to school to get caught up with the current technology. Now I'm married, and, well, I would have no health care, no way to provide for my wife while I go through school. So I was like, okay, I'll do another 3 years, and then that way I can set myself a little bit better for success when I get out. And then usually that second tour, you usually have your first kid. And then now you have a child, you got to worry about the health care and the putting food on the table and having a roof over their heads. So I was like, let me read this again. And then at that point, you're at the halfway mark.
Yeah.
So I might as well put in the full 20 to get the pension then.
Yep. And so you're a few years out now.
Yeah. If I wanted to retire exactly at 20, you know, after this tour here in Colorado, then I'll be at 20 years.
Okay, so you actually just moved, right, from Pennsylvania to Colorado?
Indiana. My last assignment was at Camp Atterbury, Indiana, but my mom still lives in Pennsylvania. So.
Okay.
We went back there during our vacation period between assignments, and that's how I end up at the symposium again in Jersey.
Yeah. And so your family's going to be here in Colorado?
Yeah, my wife and
while
the kids
go
are
on
all
tour?
Here. Yep.
Do you know how long your tour is going to be?
It'll be about 9 months.
9 months, okay. Well, we'll keep you in our thoughts and prayers for sure.
It'll be number seven.
Seventh tour,
so hopefully it's the last one.
Okay. Well, let's talk a bit about your time because, you know, you've been very generous with your photos. I remember it wasn't much long ago. And first of all, I think our listeners need to know you've only been tying for, what, 2-3 years?
2.5 years or so.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And I show people your stuff and, like, you know, you hear a gasp. It's like almost like you can actually see their reaction. They're just so inspired and impressed with your flies. They're just gorgeous. Right now, I think your patterns you did for Veterans Day are my cover shot on my Facebook page, just because I love the colors, the red, white, and blue that you use there, and you have, like, the stimulators, and you have some nymphs. And tell us a little bit about, you talked to us about how you got into fly tying with that one shrimp pattern there in Hawaii.
Yep.
And then what made you progress to kind of like what you're doing now?
I had no idea that social media was a thing when it came to fly fishing, fly tying. I mean, I was clueless. It was just basically me tying flies, taking some pictures of it, and I had some friends that were also, they had been fly fishing for years, and they found out that I got into it. They're like, hey, why don't you show us some of these flies that you're tying? Let's check them out. So I started posting some of them up on my Facebook page, and then a lot of them were like, hey, why don't you join some of these groups here? You know, it's other fly tires, and they post other flies. They'll give you some ideas. And so I started joining some of these other community pages, and I was like, oh, wow, there's a whole world out here. And I still wasn't on Instagram at that point. And then so I started posting up there, and again, I started getting all these weird random friend requests from people I had no idea who I was. Yeah. And so it started piling up. And then a couple of them were like, why don't you open up an Instagram account? And then you can, that way you get your flies out through the entire world instead of just a part of the U.S. or whatnot. Because there's a lot of people that would be interested in these patterns from South America, Europe, or wherever. And you get some good ideas from them, too. And I was like, how do I do that? I didn't even know what Instagram was.
Yeah.
So I went and opened up the Instagram page. And then in a year and a half time frame, I ended up with, like, I think it was like 12, 13,000 followers from people that just like looking at these flies. And then now, almost 2 years later, I opened up my Instagram account, April of 2017, I think it was. So this coming April will be two years. I've got almost 25,000 followers from people just interested in fly tying.
That's just amazing.
And a lot of it is the photography.
Yeah. And I remember it was probably only like a year ago, not even, that you started like really researching. You were asking people about cameras, and I think we were talking online about what equipment to use, and you really kind of dialed in your photography about like a year ago.
I was an amateur photographer for years, back in the film days, so I knew a lot about proper focal lengths and depth of field and background lighting and all that, but I didn't know, you know, what are the good SLRs that would basically the digital ones for nowadays, and then how the lens are play a part with the magnifiers between a full frame versus some of the other ones. And when I did the research on there, I found out that, you know, a lot of it was the same as film. It's just all digital. So that's when I went out, just bought my first SLR. I've got a Canon 7D, and then went out and got the old steady Canon 100mm macro lens, and from there, it just kind of took off.
And that's your main utensils right now? Yeah. Is the 7D?
I have the 7D. People ask me all the time, I'm like, you know, what I use to take photos with. I tell them, hey, you could do the exact same thing I'm doing right now. It'll cost you less than $600.
So it's the 7D?
The 7D.
And the 100 macro.
Yep, 100mm f2.8 macro. So you could buy
lighting.
Lighting, it's like a different creature itself. I have
ring light?
I use a ring light sometimes, but I mainly use LED lamps because every fly is going to be different based on the colors and size and whatnot. So there's no one lighting feature that will cover all flies. If you want pure black background, you know, it's going to require different lighting. It's going to require a shadow box. And then, I could go on for hours about photography because there's just so much that goes into it. The key thing is the lighting in the background. The equipment is important too, but it's secondary. You can literally do a lot of good photography with the cell phones nowadays.
Yep.
If you have the proper lighting in the background. But if you want to get that perfect shot, you can't just say this light with this background. It's going to flex with the color of the fly and also the size of the fly, the where you're taking the shots at, whether it's an indoor, whether it's outdoor, it's all different.
And so you're using like black velvet. I know, because a lot of your shots are just straight black and they just pop off the black background.
Well, that's where the depth of field comes in, where if you basically, you take a shot and depending on your aperture, a lot of people, if you set your aperture, let's say at stop 11, you're going to get a lot more detail in the fly, but then your background isn't as blurred out. So while it's great for details, it doesn't give you that nice visual effect where the fly becomes almost three-dimensional. So that's where you have to basically drop it down to like, you know, 4 or 6 aperture. Now, what happens when you drop it down that low is a good portion of the fly is going to be focused, but then a lot of it's going to be blurred out. So that's where the focus stacking comes in. And that requires you to basically take 7, 8, 10 frames of the same fly, but different portions of it, and then you combine all those images in the one to get that crystal clear image. And then...
You're kidding.
No, that's how you... If you want to get a crystal clear image of a fly that's this big, that's the only way to do it because it's so small.
You're stacking multiple images in different
focus. I don't always do that. That's for some of them I will. And then usually for the larger flies...
In Photoshop?
Yeah, in Photoshop. I'm not altering the image at all. All I'm doing is just stacking different portions of that fly to get that one image in order to get the full crystal clear image.
So you're on a tripod.
Yep, with a remote timer.
and you're just changing the focus point of the fly.
Yep, I jump. Basically, I do all manual points on there. So, for example, the first shot I'll take might be like the hook eye. Second one, I'll jump over to the bead if we're doing a nymph. And then I just basically can.
How do you blend the images?
Photoshop. There's a photo stacking program on there.
Oh, you use the software for that?
Yeah.
You don't like cut out the different parts?
No. And that's just for certain images, but for example, like some heavily hackled flies, they look better when part of the hackle is actually blurred because it gives it that really smooth effect.
Right.
So I will focus stack on my dry flies just for some of the nymphs.
You've really become known. I mean, you're known for a lot of things, but I mean, you're known for your stimulators, right? That's like your signature fly.
I love tying dry flies. I mean, that's how I got my start was with the dry flies. I love manipulating hackle and basically, there's no such thing as a perfectly tied fly, but if you always strive to try to get that perfectly tied fly, there's always room for improvement. And for me, it's trying to get that perfect hackle wrap every single time. Been fortunate that I'm sponsored by Whiting Farms, so they give me piles and piles of hackle to play with. And then there's a lot of other good companies out there that have took me under their wing and provided me with a lot of materials for me to continue to grow as a tire, like Semperfly, Regal Vice, Jay Stockard. All of them have helped me out one way or another, Solaris with their resins. So with that being said, the reason why I bring them up is I either get the stuff at no cost or at a drastic discount, which allows me to experiment. And that's where you see all these various different color Copper Johns out there with like every single color wire and not worry about the expenses because, you know, fly tying does get expensive. You start buying a spool of wire here for $3 and then you end up with like 30 spools, you know. That's just $150 in just wire alone.
Yeah.
Where I got Ziploc bags full of wire that was, you know, provided to me that for me to just play with and experiment.
I know you care a lot about Dr. Whiting and Whiting Farms, and you really appreciate their products. And especially being here now in Colorado, you've got a chance to go over and visit.
I was actually there in July this year already.
Yep.
Where I went out there to Delta and Montrose area and visited the farm. Spent about an hour with Dr. Whiting. You know, he took me around the facility, showed me how he goes about with his genetic breeding, and that man there knows more about chickens than anybody I know on the face of the earth. He loves his chickens. He loves perfecting the hackle, and that's his passion. He doesn't even fly fish.
Yeah,
but he and they're actually really good for the tires because he's so objective when it comes to the quality of his birds. He's not basing it off of flies or fishing itself. He's just basing it off of just basically getting that perfect hackle off of each of his chickens.
That's incredible. Let's not mistake you for just a fly tire. You're quite a fly fisherman yourself. I know you've done a lot in the Steelhead area up in New York and Pennsylvania. And then also now you're posting some great pictures from some of your trips here in Colorado.
Well, each area of the U.S. is very unique, and that's one of the reasons why I love fly fishing so much. Whether you go to the Cumberland Valley in Pennsylvania and you're fishing the limestone spring creeks, or you go out to the middle central PA and you're fishing, you know, the freestones, or you go up towards Erie and you're fishing the trips. And then out here in Colorado, you have, you know, tailwaters and you got big rivers, you got the alpine lakes. Each of those regions is going to be a little bit different because of bug life. And that's where the flies being a tire really is beneficial because before you go on your trip, you study what the fish are feeding on there. You could tie the appropriate flies for those fish, and the fish are going to be different because if they eat, you know, a lot of scuds, they're going to have different coloration than if they were to eat a lot of midges, a lot of mayflies, caddis, whatever the case may be. So regardless of where you go, trout are always going to feed on different bug life. Here to Colorado, they feed on a lot of midges because they're in a lot of tailwaters and it's easy pickings for them. And then at the same time, each area is going to be a little bit, takes different techniques to catch the fish because here it's a little bit more technical. They get a lot of pressure, they get tailwaters, they get a lot of small flies. You go down to the San Juans, the same deal where you got a lot of quality fish, but they're feeding on a lot of tiny stuff. You go out to Pennsylvania and fish some of the big waters out towards the upper Delaware. You know, you throw a lot of streamers, central part of PA, mix of everything. When you're fishing Penn's Creek or Elk or any of those other creeks out there, you can throw basically a wide array. So you can't just basically go and say, I'm going to go to Montana, or I'm going to go here and then bring, you know, one box of flies and be like, I'm going to fish this. You have to actually understand what the temperature is, different time of year, what the fish are feeding on, what the trends are because come wintertime, you know, fish are more sluggish. They're not going to move as much. So you could throw a big stream, and you might catch a fish here and there, but you're not going to be nearly as prolific if you were to throw, if you're going to nymph and throw midges out there, because they're going to sit down there in the deeper holes, and they're just going to basically open their mouths up and down and suck in all the midges that are coming by, requiring less energy on their part. So you have to understand the temperature of the water and the waters you're fishing, how deep it is, and what the fish are like. But generally, as a rule of thumb, as it gets colder, fish are going to be more sluggish, and they're going to basically... It's going to take a lot more work in order to catch them. Once it starts warming up and the metabolism kicks in, they're a little bit more active, and then you can throw some bigger stuff. But you can't just go to one area and try to just bring one size fly and say, I'm going to fish this.
Right. Let me ask you a question, Son. Do you reverse engineer everything?
Yes. I can't help it.
So far, every topic, you have taken it to the nth degree, reverse engineered it, and now you're a perfectionist.
I mean, it comes with the casting and everything is a science. It doesn't matter whether it's a time.
No, it comes with being Son, I think is what it comes with.
Because there's a lot of physics behind the cast, and they try to get that perfect cast out there. There's science to everything.
That's so cool, man. It's been awesome to have you on the podcast.
Yeah,
I know we've been trying
it.
To connect forever, and, you know, it's been a blast to hear your story. And really, I had no idea about the origins of your story here, and to have you share that with us on the podcast, I really feel honored. So thank you for sharing your story with us, and we'll continue to look out on your IG. What is your IG? Let's let people connect with you.
It's just my first name, Son, S-O-N, _ Tao, T-A-O, and that's it.
And then we have the Tao Flies?
I'm not as active nearly as much as I should be on Facebook, but... I hit the limit on my friends at when I hit 5,000.
I know you were getting close. I threw my name in there real quick before you got to 5.
So that's when I opened up that blog, because all the people that can't get the friend requested because of the limit. So I opened up that blog, and it has like almost 7,000 followers on there, so they can keep track of what I'm doing as far as my trips and my flies. And then on Instagram, you know, there's no limit.
The Tower Flies.
Up on Facebook, and then on Instagram, Son_Tao.
Yeah, that's so cool. And I thank you and I know both Chuck and Ben, thank you for your generosity with your photos, because we're using a lot of your photos in marketing the tying symposium and the show. And you've been really great for some of the marketing and allowing us to do that, Son. So thank you so much. And thank you for being on our podcast.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you. Take it easy, Rob.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.